All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksikins, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Thank you for joining. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. I hope your day is going okay, or your evening, or your drive, or your workout, or whatever the fuck you're doing. I hope it's okay. I hope you're enjoying life. I hope you're engaging in it. I'm in a hotel room as we speak. I'm out here. I'm out here in the country, in the great American countryside, kind of. I'm in Burlington, Vermont, and we drove up. Sarah and I did the thing. We flew into New York. We hit New Haven, did that show. Great show. Then we went up to Troy, New York, and tonight in Burlington. I'm recording this before the show. I'll tell you a little bit about the trip. Sure, I will. Why not? But let's do this first, because I wanted to. My buddy Todd Barry, he texted me, and he's got this book out. He sent it to me. It's very funny. Todd is very funny. The book is very funny. It's called Thank You for Coming to Hattiesburg, One Comedian's Tour of Not Quite the Biggest Cities in the World. He calls it part tour diary, part travel guide, and part memoir. And because it's Todd, you know it's hilarious. It's out in bookstores tomorrow, but you can pre-order it right now. Todd Barry's new book. All right? So did I mention Kevin Nealon is on the show? That was a long time coming because, quite honestly, I didn't think Kevin Nealon liked me. I thought we had a problem. We discussed it. So New Haven was a... It was great to be there. We were basically on the Yale campus, and it was a very pleasant hotel. And we went, you know, because Sarah is a artiste, so she like checked out what was at the gallery, and we wanted to see what was there. I got the little brochure thing right here. Small and Great Objects: Annie and Joseph Albers in the Americas. Now, though they were both artists, Joseph Albers was an abstract guy, did squares, did colors. Annie did a lot of textile work, weavings and whatnot. And this was a collection of little artifacts and bits of sculptures and weird figurines from Mexico and Latin America. And they kind of, you know, connected those things with the influence on him and art in general. And, you know, it was a learning experience. And a lot of times I need to kind of be, you know, it takes a lot for me to go to the museum, but it was just down the street. And it was, I always am happy when I go there, because you should go. It's important, whether you think it's important or not, or whether you don't go very often. Got to go look at the art. Go look at the paintings. Go look what creative freedom looks like. Go look what putting it all on the line for a canvas looks like. Go look at what portals into the great unknown, the secret spirits of pure creation feel like. Don't let it go away. They require your attention. You don't have to look at everything. I know it's exhausting, especially the historical stuff, but go lock in for a few minutes to the art so you get your brain configured correctly. All right? That's all. Public service announcement for art in general. But then we go back to the hotel, and we're going to have some coffee in the lobby. And we almost sat, like, there was these two seats looking out the window, but they were too close to this couple that was sitting there enjoying their coffee or lunch or bread. And we decided not to sit there because we felt we'd be looking right at him. So we sat across the way from him. And then I realized, I'm like, that guy looks familiar. And I'm like, oh yeah, he does. And then I look across from him and I'm like, holy shit, that's Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep was just sitting there in the lobby bar of the hotel we were staying at, having some bread and meat. And I recognized her husband because he's always sitting next to her being her husband. I don't know that guy. I don't know what he does, but I knew it was him. I recognized him because she's one of those people where you're like, that's her husband? I wonder what he does. Who's that guy? It's easy information to find, I'm sure. I never did. I want to keep it a mystery. So I'm just looking at her. I'm not staring at her, but I was like trying not to look at her, but you kind of want to look at her because it's Meryl Streep, the greatest actress that ever lived, and somebody who was an outspoken person and sort of important to the cultural dialogue at this juncture in history. And also, how can you not fucking love her work, right? I was just taking in her technique. You know, she was eating bread and having some coffee, I believe, maybe a water, also using her phone a bit. And I just wanted to see how she approached that stuff because she's a professional. And I got to say, it was brilliant. She ate her bread brilliantly. It was very, seemed very real, seemed very like she was committed to eating some bread and meat, but also like her phone style was like, it was like she was really in it. She was like definitely checking her phone. Just, it was a brilliant performance all around. And I was happy to have the seats that I had. So New Haven, that was a great show. And then we drove up to Troy. Troy's an old New York City, upstate New York. I'll tell you something about driving through, you know, Connecticut, and we were taking the small county roads, Connecticut, upstate New York, Vermont. Is one thing you notice after a little while is there's definitely been some slacking on in the barn repair department. Barn maintenance, I think, is at an all-time low, but from the looks of some of these barns, it's been declining for probably a century. And, it adds something to the landscape. I don't know if that's why people don't fix the barns. I mean, there are some dilapidated old fucking barns out there, but you're like, that's cool. But part of you is like, I guess, you know, just generations of people have looked out at that thing and said, nah, it's all right. No, we don't need to paint it. We don't need to fix it. All right, maybe you just nail that one board on, but don't hit it too hard because the whole thing could go. You see barns and you're like, there is that even, it, can you use, holy shit, there's stuff in it. I mean, I'm not encouraging people. I'm just maybe a heads up that, you know, take a look at the barn. It looks like it's about to go, though it's very charming and it makes the landscape much more engaging and interesting and historical. Maybe there's a law in all these states. Hey, if you've got a barn built before 1800, don't fuck with it. Let it just crumble into itself over a century because it looks cool. I don't know. I don't know how it works up here. Troy Music Hall. What a fucking place that was, built in the 1800s. Acoustically perfect. And like the seats that they have there are still the seats. The guy told me they were all cast as entire rows. That the iron was, they're not separate seats. They were cast iron as entire rows. And underneath there's still the little hook thing, the little thing that you stick your top hat in, and on the back of each chair there was a little pouch, a little metal hook for women's shawls, top hats and shawls. That's how far that goes back. And it's weird with these halls that are acoustically perfect, where there's an intimacy to them that transcends even like a small black box theater. I don't know why, but just the way the chairs were situated and how the people sat on the lower level, and I filled up that second balcony too. I did all right these shows. People are coming out having a nice time. But just the way that seats were situated, that they couldn't change them, that there was nothing modern about the seat situation, just the way it was tiered looked a little 1800s-y. Like I could picture people sitting in their 1800s clothes. And obviously a couple of hipsters were there, so they were there. But I could just see and feel the history of the place. Sometimes the venue's history transcends any crowd or any performance that's in there. It is of itself. And you feel it, and it's humanizing somehow, because you can't transcend something that old in structure and sound, and it just makes it so no matter how technologically advanced anything's become, that you're just people sitting in something that was built before microphones to sound perfect, and it was bigger than the people, so the people were small, and it made it very sweet and intimate. Marina Franklin opened for me these last two nights, and it was, she did a great job. Should I read an email real quick while I'm sitting here? Yeah, I do like to, it's not so much tooting my own horn, but I'm always surprised at some of the emails I get and how the show influences people. This just says, interview impact in the subject line. Hi, Mark. I loved your interview with Bruce Springsteen and made a strong impact on me. What struck me was the warmth and compassion you elicited from Mr. Springsteen in the moment, all caps. Through your willingness to engage him from the heart with honesty and humility and vulnerability, clearly he was willing to accept your invitation. And in the joy of that genuine moment in which two people were fully present to each other, Mr. Springsteen's humanity and his journey became evident. It's a very nice thing to say, but this is what was I found very touching for me. Interviewing is a key part of my job, conducting forensic clinical assessments for juvenile court. And this got me thinking about the process. I get one shot, around an hour with the kid and an hour or so with the parent, to gather not only the relevant family, school, and social history, but also to gain an understanding of how the youth came to be involved in delinquency, what interventions might help prevent further delinquency, and how willing or able the family might be to engage in services. Under these demands, I have resorted to checklists and guides and adopted a business-like manner, which does not invite more detail than needed, thank you. But your interviews with Mr. Springsteen reminded me of the value of bringing something of yourself to the table, whether it's apologizing that my office is freezing cold or acknowledging that as parents we never stop worrying. I'm again taking the time and making the effort to connect in some small way. I hope it helps the families I meet feel seen and cared for. At the very least, it reminds me that's what it's really about, being present, connecting, and trying to make this moment a little better for each other, which is what you do. Thank you, Jamie. Yeah, this is very touching to me because I'm glad I helped out. That makes sense. That, you know, like that, those, of course, those things, you know, would be good to connect. But I would like to say, Jamie, perhaps maybe a space heater would be good in the office if it's that cold. If it's something you'd have to say more than once. Sorry, it's so cold in here. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm crazy, but space heater might be good. So Kevin Nealon, I've always liked him. I thought he was hilarious on Update. I've been a fan of his comedy, and I saw him last at the Gary Shandling Memorial, and he was emotional and brilliant and hilarious, but touching. And it really gave me a whole different perspective on him, and I had to have him on. But I was concerned that he didn't like me. So we'll talk about that, among other things. He's currently on the CBS show Man with a Plan, which airs Monday nights. You can go check out his comedy tour dates at kevinnealon.com. This is me and Kevin Nealon back in the garage. When I go out now, like, I just know the store will give me a bunch of spots. What do I got to run around for?
Isn't it nice how it's changed? Remember when you used to wait in line to get on?
Yeah, you wait in line, or like, you know, you'd like, you know, scramble to do nine spots everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But I started in New York. Where'd you start?
I started in Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah, but I'm from Connecticut. I went to New York to the Catch a Rising Star to see what comedy was like.
Like, what year is that?
That was in 77.
So it was like pretty good then.
It was good. It was packed. You know, Richard Belzer was the MC.
Yeah.
A lot of tough comics.
Yeah.
You know, Larry David was on, and you know, all those guys, and I would sit in the audience with everybody just jammed in there, and, you know, cigarette smoke everywhere.
Yeah,
and, you know,
watching Belzer prance around.
Yeah, hecklers. Barry Diamond. Yeah.
He's still around.
Yeah, but that scared me. That whole scene scared me in New York. I thought, I'm going to try Los Angeles, man. That's where all the prop comics are. You know, it's got to be easier. And I wasn't a prop comic,
right?
But I thought, you know, I can mix in.
Yeah, I mean, New York was like crazy, but I felt like that was really the thing. You know, I think I came out here. I don't know. LA's always been odd to me. Where'd you grow up?
Connecticut, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
All your whole life?
And Germany. I lived in Germany when I was a kid.
Why is that?
When I was six until I was 10. My father got a job for... he called it a German outfit, which would have been Lederhosen, but it was really a helicopter company.
Yeah. He was in a...
Yeah, so he worked for Sikorsky Helicopters, and they had a contract with a company over there for an army contract.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't live on a military base like a lot of the army brats, you know, and all the military people. We lived in a German neighborhood.
Yeah.
So I learned how to speak fluent German, and I went to an American school. But,
yeah, did you really? Can you still do it?
Yeah, I can still speak it. I'm not as well as I used to.
But
it's
you
kind of choppy.
Understand it.
Yeah.
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 And that comes out. That comes up a lot in everyday life in Los Angeles.
It really does. When I go down to Germantown.
German's very practical.
There's not a Germantown in LA, is there?
I don't think so. There's barely an Italian town. It's weird out here. Yeah, there's no Italians that I know of. There's no, like, do you know good Italian restaurants? Like in Connecticut, New Jersey, New York. There's a good Italian restaurant every 2 miles.
Yeah, there's good pizza places. Here's what I think, Mark. I think they should take all the little Italys across the country,
yeah,
and put them into one big city.
Yeah.
Make one big Italian city.
Little Italy?
Yeah.
So how old were you when you were in Germany?
I was six until I was 10.
So, wow. Do you remember? So you have memories of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember, like I said, I lived in a German neighborhood. Most of my friends were German.
Right.
And I would come home and I have these American toys and the German kids loved them. They had the old, like, metal lead soldiers with real paint on there.
They're hollow and
malleable.
They're
malleable. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would trade them and my mother would get pissed. She goes, you traded your good toy for crap. You know?
You trade the good plastic G.I. Joe.
Yeah. And I remember this was not long after the war ended. It was like 15 years after World War II ended.
Really?
Yeah. It's like 59.
So there's still that feeling of wreckage and weirdness?
I was a kid, so I didn't know anything about that.
You didn't,
you know,
sense the darkness?
But I do remember going to one of my friend's houses, and his father, I guess, was in the German Navy, and
yeah,
he had one of those display cases in the living room with all the U-boats in it and stuff on the
right,
fake water
right,
stuff.
Yeah.
I remember the time thinking, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, I can't imagine. Like, I've never been to Germany. Have you been back since?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was back last December.
For performing for the troops or
no,
what?
I did a river cruise down the Danube with my wife and kid.
Oh, just to go?
Yeah, yeah. We went with Vienna.
Down was it beautiful?
Oh, it's gorgeous, yeah.
I've never been to Vienna.
Oh, you got to go.
Yeah?
These cruises are great. You just sit on a boat.
Bridgeport, Connecticut. That's where didn't they have the P.T. Barnum Museum there?
Yeah. Yeah, that's where Tom Thumb is from.
He's from Bridgeport?
Yeah, yeah.
Were you sort of, you seem to know.
Richard
you know?
Bells is from Bridgeport too.
Is he really?
Yep, yep.
I had one bad experience there because there was a ferry there.
I used to watch that ferry every day go to Port Jefferson. I was a lifeguard on the beach down there.
Yeah.
And I watch it a couple times a day going back and forth. Yeah, what happened?
Well, my buddy lived in, we took the ferry over because he lived by Port Jefferson. And we were in college and we were going down there for the weekend. And we go, you know, we're kind of drunky and I went to college in Boston, yeah. Kind of hungover. We decided to go to the P.T. Barnum Museum. And, you know, some dude, old man who must have been with the circus at some point. I remember he was missing an eye and he was working there. And he said he was, you know, he could tell people's fortunes. Like, and he grabs my hand in a very awkward way and he looks at my palm and he says, "You're going to get in a very bad accident."
That's Bridgeport. That's the Bridgeport psychics.
Yeah, it's fucked
it's all
up.
Bad news psychics.
It's fucked me up for weeks. Just waiting.
That made you a better driver.
Yeah. Well, it was terrifying.
But so, Bridgeport is not like a town you would think would be in Connecticut. It's very industrial. Mm-hmm. It's a port city. A lot of gangs, mafia.
Yeah.
You know, like mafia drive-bys and stuff like that.
Really?
And I guess apparently, legend has it that Johnny Carson met with Wayne Newton at the one of the diners there on Main Street in Bridgeport to discuss some kind of a casino deal.
That's legend.
That's
Bridgeport.
That's
legend?
Bridgeport legend right there.
And it never happened.
I don't know. You would have to ask Wayne.
So you're going. You're hanging out. Your dad's like in. Was he always in airplanes and flying things?
Yeah, we had our airplanes. Like you have guitars and everything around here. He had airplanes and helicopters and constantly smelling airplane glue. Growing up my whole life. Yeah.
He made models.
Yeah, yeah. Balsa wood from scratch.
Uh huh.
You know,
with
and
the
I
razor blade. And,
razor blade. Yeah. All the different levels of balsa wood strength. You know, and
yeah.
The paper you put on the top. You know, with the glue.
With the wings.
Yeah.
That was his thing, but
yeah,
he worked for aeronautic companies.
Yeah, he's an aeronautical engineer.
Wow.
So my whole life
could
was
he fly?
Like, he did know how to fly. I don't remember him flying ever though.
Yeah.
Even though he made helicopters and helped design them and got them built, he was not a fan of helicopters.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He said, because these things.
Yeah, there's so many moving parts and they're always vibrating. You got to tighten them like every 5 seconds. You know, you got to land and tighten everything.
He didn't have a lot of faith in the helicopter.
No. I think he did, but I don't think he liked those.
Did you ever go up in them?
Yeah, I've been up in them. I don't like them.
It's kind of fun when you're up there, but yeah, as long as you don't start realizing it's just that one.
I did a movie. I did a movie a couple years ago. Walk of Shame, it's called. Uh-huh. With
Steve Brill's movie.
Yeah, Elizabeth Banks.
You know, Steve and I went to college together.
Did you really?
Yeah, we wrote together.
Oh,
we were best friends, and then it went away.
That happens, doesn't it?
It does.
But for some reason.
We're okay now. We made it. You know, he came on, and we got it back together, and I see him occasionally.
So Steve goes, you know, we got a helicopter scene. You comfortable in a helicopter? I said, not really. You know, not really. He goes, okay, we'll do a green screen.
Uh-huh.
You know, I said, okay, that'd be great. And then he goes, you know, a day before, hey, the green screen's not working out. We got a really nice helicopter. You know, it won't be a problem at all. And I'm looking at the weather. You know, it's supposed to be rainy and stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, because I don't know how to say no to people.
Right.
You know, even if my life is on the line. So I go down there and I'm driving to the location and I don't see the helicopter. It's up on the roof of a high building.
Right.
And I hate heights to begin with. So I go up there and...
oh, my God.
And he's got a whole lot of new lines for me. You know,
on top of being on
top
a building
of it,
and a helicopter.
Yeah. So we get into, it's like that one of those little helicopters, all glass in the front. So they have the cameras and stuff. And we take off from the building and he's got the cameras mounted and he's squished behind the back seat and he's going, action. And I'm going, Steve, let me just rehearse as we're going. I'm getting used to this helicopter. Okay.
Yeah.
And we hung out for like 35 minutes over the 405 freeway, Dodger Stadium. And I think this is really cool.
Right.
This is cool.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, you know, let's not push it anymore. Let's head back.
Back. We've done it. We got it.
Yeah.
So you got through the nerves.
Yeah, yeah. So that's like one of the few times I've been up in a helicopter.
Oh, God. You have a hard time saying no to people?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that an issue?
It has been with my wife.
Oh, yeah. Really?
And for me too. Yeah. And it's not good. I know.
Why?
A lot
because
of,
you spread yourself thin.
Well, yeah, you spread yourself thin, and then the people that you love the most kind of are inconvenienced because you've promised your time to other people.
Oh, or, right.
You know,
I got to go do a thing.
But it's a matter of wanting to be liked and accepted.
Right.
You know.
I had to. Yeah. It definitely. I don't know if it always pays off that way.
It doesn't. People start taking advantage of you.
Sure. You're
you
know? Like a mark.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm learning all these things later in life, you know, how to be a better partner and also to have a fuller life and be more, you know,
have those boundaries.
Honest. Yeah. And have boundaries. Yeah.
Like, no, I can't.
Oh. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I don't get mad. I get mad, but I keep it inside.
Oh, good for you. No, I dump it all over the place.
Passive aggressive and then depression. So I'm learning now to get very angry and to fight.
Really?
Yeah. So
how's it going?
We'll see in the next hour.
Well, that's funny because you say that because, like, for years, I thought you didn't like me.
I didn't like you?
Yeah. And, like, you know, the weird thing is you probably didn't feel either way because I didn't see you that often.
No, you're right. I didn't like you.
Oh, good. I was hoping you'd say
no,
that.
I liked you fine. You're another comic.
Yeah, I always felt like, you know, there was some part of it like you were almost like, oh, this guy.
I have people like that too. I think they see me, they go, oh, this guy.
Yeah.
This guy. No, it was not this guy. It was that guy.
Oh, it was that guy.
Yeah. No, I had no, I didn't know you that well. I knew you were a funny comic and, you know, you did your thing. You had a certain style and I had my whole life. I think a lot of that, sometimes we are perceiving like our own insecurities, you know.
Well, that's right. But like the fact that you say that, like, you know, a lot of times when, if you're one of those people that keeps your anger in and you control all that stuff, there's part of me that's sort of like, what's he got? What has he got going on? You know, I can't read that guy. What's up with that guy?
This is such a screwy business, man. It attracts the most insecure people.
I know.
You know, and odds are you're not going to make it. You know?
It's true.
And yet we stay with it. We stay with it.
Isn't that weird? Because like at some point you don't have a choice. Like you don't even, there's nothing in your brain that's sort of like, I could always, you know, there was never any answer to that.
Yeah.
That was practical.
It gets to a point where you're too far in and you can't back out. And I always had my BS in marketing to fall back on.
Oh, you went to college and did that?
Yeah, I have a BS in marketing. But I just got a letter from the college telling me that I can no longer fall back on it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been expired.
Not going to help you.
No.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Sacred Heart University in Connecticut.
Catholic?
School.
Is that Catholic?
It was Catholic, but you couldn't tell it was.
We brought up Catholic?
Yeah.
Like hardcore?
Nah, well, you know, just church on Sundays.
Oh, yeah?
You get there before the communion.
Scared
you
know, of hell?
5 minutes. No.
No, good.
Not anymore.
Not after show business?
Is that tobacco you're spitting in there?
No, it's a coffee.
Oh, God. I was going to say, that's a lot of tobacco spit.
I wouldn't do that. I've done that occasionally in my life. I enjoy a dip occasionally.
Yeah.
So
I was raised Catholic.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers, two sisters.
Oh, so it's big.
Yeah. And I have a son. I have a 10-year-old who is not raised in any religion.
You're not giving him that? You're not going to do that?
He believes in God.
He does?
We taught him that, yeah. He believes in there's a higher power.
Yeah.
And you know, my wife and I, we thought we'd teach him about all different religions and let him choose. But that doesn't really happen.
No, not a certain.
And I always thought, you know, growing up, she said, you know, we're not going to baptize him or anything. That's ridiculous because she wasn't raised Catholic. And I said, okay. But in my head, I'm thinking, well, I'll just take him one day when he's like, you know, 8 months old, not tell her, have the priest baptize him, boom.
Hedge your
bets. Just in case, you know, just in case. And then I let too much time go by. And now he'll tell her. Now he'll tell her if I do that.
You can't hide the secret?
No.
No. So he's unbaptized. He's just out there in the world defenseless against whatever not being baptized makes you vulnerable to.
Yeah, but I will tell you that I am an ordained minister now.
What?
I did a thing for the Ellen Show where I could, they wanted me to marry some people at the Little White Wedding Chapel.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was doing some field pieces for her. So they got me ordained.
With the Universal Church or whatever?
With the Open Ministry.
Yeah.
On the World Wide Web. And so I did that. You know, I did some funky marriages out there. And then I just married a friend of mine the other day, Kirk Fox. I was looking over my thing to make sure this was going to be legal, you know, so I was doing research. And then it says on there that I could also baptize people.
Really?
Yes.
In what, in any church or like how
I guess
that
in
work?
The open ministry thing, just baptize somebody. Doesn't have to be any
that
denomination.
Easy.
I guess so.
That's is this something you're going to do? Like, is this maybe like if things start to get thin, you know, with the show business career?
I might baptize my wife and my kid.
While they're
just
sleeping?
Just to be sure, yeah.
Why am I wet?
What do I smell burning?
Yeah.
I'm smoking reefer.
It's an accident. So, all right. So when do you become disillusioned with the BS in marketing? What kind of jobs were you doing?
You would be a great police interrogator.
Really?
So you came out of the shop with your friend at about 8 o'clock.
Yeah. And then what
were you thinking?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was dark.
Why were you holding the gun?
Yeah. I only went to get my degree in marketing because I didn't know what I wanted to do. Or that's I was afraid to get into comedy.
But that's one of those weird degrees. Did you actually learn anything? It seems like one of those kind of BS's.
You know, I learned how to get work done and to meet deadlines, mm-hmm. if anything. And I kind of learned about subliminal advertising, mm-hmm. which became one of the bits I did.
A famous bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also I was interested in music too at the time, like you. I love the guitar. I grew up playing the guitar and the banjo, the 5-string banjo.
Really? You're a good banjo player?
Not bad. I play with Steve Martin once in a while. You know, we recorded the theme to Weeds.
Oh, yeah?
On one of the episodes.
I could see you guys being friends. You guys are pals?
Yeah, yeah.
He's real good, though, right?
Yeah, he's really good. I don't see him that often, but, you know, when he's in town, I see him. But I'm not, like, a big bluegrass fan. I don't enjoy listening to a lot of bluegrass music.
So do you play, like, blues banjo?
No, I just play bluegrass songs, but I don't play that often. I'll pick it up every once in a while. And I'm looking for a lot of, like, I play the guitar not that well. I've been playing forever.
Me too,
maybe 10 guitars at home. Nice ones. And then I just got a ukulele that I'm learning how to play. That's fun. I have a mandolin.
It's like meditative for me to play, to sort of take the time to do it. I don't have many things. I don't have children or wives.
Right.
I don't know how to meditate, but if I lock into the guitar for a half hour,
that's meditation.
Good.
Yeah,
it is kind of, isn't it?
Yeah, but I am playing the piano now. I started taking lessons last July.
Really?
Somebody goes, why now? Why now?
It's yeah.
Like, what am I going to die? You know, why not now?
How are you doing with that with the
I love
two
it.
Hands? Are you good? Because it feels to me like to get the two hands doing different things hard.
Well, that's what you do on a guitar.
I guess that's true.
But that is a little difficult. And also you're reading two different lines of music.
I can't read
the
music.
Bass and the,
right.
the whatever they call it, the clef and the treble.
And you can do that?
I'm learning how to do it. It's not easy, but it's a challenge. And I do like it. I mean, you know, you really can understand music a lot better than what you're looking at on the fretboard.
Yeah.
You know, because it's all laid out there for you. You see all the notes.
Yeah.
And you could see all the chord.
And design. You can kind of hear it.
Yeah.
And see where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just the three chords.
Yeah.
Going to go up to an A now.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm learning why an A minor is an A minor.
Mm.
You know, where I didn't really know on the guitar. I just knew how to form it, you know.
Right. Yeah. You take that finger off and put the other one there. It sounds different.
Yeah.
It's sad now.
It's sad, but I do like it.
Did you play in bands?
I was in a few garage bands. We weren't that good.
You didn't play out?
We played at our parties. We would have the party and we would hire ourselves at the band.
Right. You had like six songs.
We started playing them over again. Yeah. Yeah.
So where'd the comedy bug hit?
The comedy thing came from, like a lot of comics, I was very quiet growing up, very shy.
Really?
Yeah.
I was
the
opposite kind.
Were you?
Yeah. Never shut up, annoyed people, disruptive in class.
So you had to be funny then.
Get kicked out of school.
Yeah, yeah.
You
had to have a reason for doing that. I loved practical jokes. I loved the fake brandy glass. Looked like you were going to throw it at somebody. And
I remember that.
Out.
I had one of those, yeah.
The fake puke, the fake melting ice cream.
Sure.
I love getting reactions from people like that. And then, you know.
The surprise.
The surprise.
Yeah.
And then as a family, we traveled a lot through Europe in cars. You know, we drove a lot on vacations. I learned how to swim in Greece. I learned how to ski in Austria. And so my brother and my sister and I were in the car together a lot. My other brother and sister weren't born for 12 years later. But so we had to keep ourselves busy and entertained.
Sure.
And so we're always trying to outdo each other.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I started developing the comedy. And then, you know, probably like you, I grew up watching Jerry Lewis movies and...
not so much Jerry, but I think I was more... I'm trying to think, like Woody Allen, I think,
Woody
was
Allen
really
too,
the thing that was sort of like, holy shit, that's funny.
Yeah, Woody Allen came too. And then I liked guys like Albert Brooks and Steve Martin and Andy Kaufman because they were so unique and original.
Yeah, my guys early on, I think like Buddy Hackett, like actually, like when I was real young.
Yeah, yeah, that was wrong. That's not right.
Yeah, Jackie Vernon.
Also wrong.
Yeah, and then like later I got the records, you know. I got the Richard Pryor records, the George Carlin records, Cheech and Chong records.
Yeah,
it was the records, you know.
The records, Bill Cosby too.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Chicken Heart. Chickenheart and the First Family. Did you listen to them, the Kennedy, the First Family?
I didn't listen to them. There's a little too much going on for me.
Hey, speaking of Jackie Vernon, I worked with him a couple of times.
You did?
Before he died, yeah. In Houston, I remember.
I just bought a record yesterday. A Jackie Vernon record with a watermelon on front. I don't know what he's doing. I got two comedy records yesterday because I pick them up if I don't have them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a lot of comedy records. But what was that like?
It was interesting. It was early in my career, and I was opening for him. And
where?
In Houston.
Huh.
I think Houston and somewhere else. And he was, he'd been doing it forever. He was out. His idea of during the day, he would go to a pharmacy and he'd get a shopping cart in the pharmacy.
Yeah.
And he loved to get anything that came with like a free umbrella or free cologne with it.
Anything with the extra thing.
And he'd get a lot of hair dye.
Uh-huh.
And he would go to the hotel and he'd show up at the club that night and he had jet black hair.
Really?
Know? Yeah. And he did his famous, the slideshow. Yeah. And that was it. He flirted with the waitresses.
Uh-huh.
You know.
What year was that? Because I saw him when I was like 11. And that was sort of a life-changing thing for me. My parents took me to a lounge to see him. And we were close. And he was just sitting there. And I could just see the weird beaded sweat. And he was old.
He did sweat.
You know, and he was sort of, just kind of walking through it. But it felt dirty. You know, like just to be that close to a comic at that age doing that thing that he's done a million times. It felt like, well, this is a different world.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever that is, I want a part of that.
Well, a lot of those comics from back then, they didn't work in comedy clubs. They worked in the strip clubs coming up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same with like Rodney Dangerfield.
Did you know him?
I met him. I was close to a guy from Car 54, Joey Ross.
Oh, my God. He's a notorious monster.
He's a monster.
Well, like he's from being a comic for years that there is a spectrum of behavior.
Yeah.
That comics are prone to.
Right, right.
And he was far end of the spectrum.
Yeah, well, I knew that he took a real liking to me. I was bartending at the Improv. Uh-huh. This was like around 1980.
Yeah.
And he would come in, he knew I was an aspiring comic and we'd get on stage together sometimes, and we'd do like bits, like he'd have the cigar and we'd talk like we'd been doing vaudeville forever,
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
And one day he came into the Improv and he goes, I might have a job for you.
Yeah.
He goes, what do you get played in a club, like $25? I said, yeah. He goes, what is it, Joey? I said, I'll tell you. Let me think of it. I'll get back to you. I'll tell you now. And I took us.
Yeah.
And he goes, I just married Trudy.
Yeah.
I guess her name was Trudy. I forget her name, but she was this ex-prostitute.
Sure.
That had her eye shot out in Dallas, I think, a long time ago.
And, a one-eyed prostitute.
A glass eye.
Yeah.
And he married her.
Yeah.
And he said, you come from a good family. You're a funny guy.
Yeah.
Good looking. And he said, she wants to have a kid. I'm 7 years old and I can't, I'm 70. I can't, nothing's happening down there. So, I'll give you what you get in the club, $25. You go up there and she'll show you a good time too. And and I'm looking at him thinking, this is a joke, right? It's a joke. And he was serious. I said, Joey, let me think about this. You think about it.
Yeah.
He comes in the next day, sees me, makes a beeline to me. Because, she's back home thinking, what'd he say?
Yeah, right.
He comes over, he goes, what do you think? What do you think? I said, Joey, I'm flattered, first of all.
Yeah.
But it's, it's not really, I'm really trying to get into comedy. I'm trying to focus on that.
I can't knock up your wife right now.
He said, come on. I said, okay. So, because I can't say no. So I got a 22-year-old somewhere.
No.
No, I'm kidding. Mm-hmm. But
You were able to say no on that one, huh?
I did say no on that one.
But did he up the ante? Did he say like $50?
No, he didn't. I should have got my agent involved. But yeah, those guys all came from a whole different generation of comedy.
So now you graduate college. How do you say, I'm going to do this?
Well, like I said, I wanted to get into music. I loved Crosby, Stills, and Nash and James Taylor, that whole thing.
So you wanted to be a folk singer.
So I wanted to be in a band like that.
Yeah, sweet music.
Yeah, and it was so hard to I would go to all the coffee houses at college and I'd listen to all the music and I'd play with a candle and have a ball of wax all over my fingers, stay there for the whole thing.
Trying to get up the courage.
Yeah, but I wasn't even on the list. I was just there to watch
because
I thought I might want to do that. And I was so nervous about singing in front of people. It seemed so intimate.
Terrifying. I feel the same way.
Comedy seemed much easier.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I'm terrified of singing in front of people.
Yeah. So I remember I was raking leaves once after college. I was back home raking leaves and the radio was on. I had the radio outside listening to music. And a report came on that Freddie Prinze died.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I, we all knew Freddie Prinze. And And it dawned on me then what an impact comedy has on life,
right?
On people,
right?
And I thought, I in a sense, I almost thought there was an opening in L.A.
Since
he died, so I came out here and
that's one down. I got this guy. They probably need somebody.
Yeah. And I moved to San Diego at first. You know, I drove my grandfather's old car out here. It had over 100,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
Back then, that was a lot of miles.
Yeah.
And breezed through L.A., stopped, met Bud Freeman, saw the Improv, went down to San Diego. Me and my buddy hung out there. We got more jobs working as department store Santa Claus is down there.
You met Bud Freeman?
Yeah.
Would you just go by to do an open mic? Or
no,
that
we
work?
Went like in the afternoon. We stopped in there just to check out the club.
Oh, yeah.
And he was there.
Yeah.
And
with his monocle?
Yeah. No, this is before the monocle.
Oh, yeah.
And he was showing me the newspaper clippings on the walls.
What
stuff.
Year
is
that?
Very nice. This is 78.
Oh, okay. So yeah. It's like... sort of heading into that first boom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you go to San Diego?
So I go to San Diego, and my intention is to go back to L.A. My buddy met a girl down in San Diego. They ended up getting married, still married, two kids. But I slept on their couch for a little bit. Then I would go to the Comedy Store in La Jolla to watch. And there was two guys there. I didn't know who was who. And one of them had a gap between the teeth, and the other one had a big chin. And it was Letterman and Leno.
Oh, you know? She and was sending them down there to do the weekends.
Yeah. And I would see Johnny Dark down there.
Johnny Dark.
Kip Adada.
Kip.
And I thought, these guys are great, man.
They were great.
And I would see Robin Williams.
Yeah?
Like at the Laugh Stop.
So that place was open all the way back then.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so funny, that place, like as the years went by and the ivy crawled up the sides of the structure. Did you see, like a few years ago, I don't remember the last time I did La Jolla, but I went down there and it's in the middle of San Diego. The entire place is covered in ivy. It was like the earth was trying to take it back. Yeah. Like, it was like, how could she, franchise the haunted nature of that fucking place on Sunset down to San Diego? And I'm like, you walk into that place and you're like, it's just as fucking dark and weird as the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
you know, you see the MC and you go, wow, this guy's good.
Yeah.
This is before you kind of knew about comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the opener would come on, you go, oh, that guy's good. Oh, that's better than the MC. Yeah. And the middle guy come on, oh, no one's going to be better than this guy. And then the MC, the headliner comes out, oh my God.
Right. It's amazing.
Know? Yeah, yeah.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah. So after that, Mark, I just went up to LA. You know, I slept on some couches for a while and got in a really cheap apartment with a roommate, $135 a month. We split it two ways, $67.50.
Where was it?
It was near Paramount.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Hollywood.
What was the other guy doing?
He was a you know, aspiring comic.
What happened to that guy?
He went back to LA, to Ohio.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Threw
the towel in, which is commendable. Some people don't know when to throw it in.
That's for fucking sure.
That's the problem with this business. You never know.
Who's going to fire you? You. Yeah. And then after a certain point, it becomes a pride thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you start? Where do you go?
Well, you know, you try to come up with your own style. You don't have that at the beginning because you're emulating. Everybody's emulating somebody. Back then, they were emulating either Letterman or Richard Pryor, or Woody Allen, and so you go to open mic nights at the Comedy Store or the Improv
potluck
Monday. Potluck,
yeah,
that's what I did. You know, I hit all the open mic club, try to get a style together.
You were conscious of that?
Yeah, I worked at the Improv as a bartender, so I was there at the heyday when the room was packed and Robin was coming back from Mork and Mindy.
78, 79, 80,
around there.
Really?
He had the suspenders on from Mork and Mindy. He'd go in and kill it. You know, Andy Kaufman would go on and I'd be watching from like a little peephole up in the office.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
and Richard Lewis, destroyed. You know, all these
New Yorkers. You saw all those guys, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Leno. Yeah, they'd been there like 2 or 3 years by that point, right?
Those were the established comics.
Right, yeah. Because like I guess the scene really started in earnest like 74, 75, right? 73, the guys started coming out.
Yeah, I think so. And then there was the strike,
the
big strike, which was, I remember being at the Improv and somebody coming in saying, Steve Lubetkin just jumped off the Hyatt.
Oh my God. And, did you know him?
I did. I knew of him. I saw him. You know, I watched him. But Richard Lewis
was his
best friend. He was at the club at the time when this guy came in and said it, and he just freaked. He ran out and almost got hit by a car in Melrose.
My God!
So there was a lot of tension during that time. You know, who's working at what club? Who's striking? Who's not? You know,
it's funny because you know I had Jimmy Walker in here, and. You know, he played both clubs, and Bud thought, you know, he owed him in the Mitzi. But you know, Jimmy was just doing what he was doing, and he brought up the fact that you know it was still not. This was like a couple of years ago. He said, you know, Bud's still mad at me for that. I'm like, come on, right? And then like I had Bud in here, and sure enough, you know, I said, you have any grudges? Like, you know, Jimmy Walker. I was like, unbelievable. But then there was the fire, right? Were you there?
I was there that night. Yeah.
What the hell happened there?
I was bartending. Jack Grayman came out of the back showroom.
Jack Grayman.
Yep. A comic.
Yeah. All those pictures in the Comedy Store. Yeah. Like you put faces to him. Yeah, I know.
And he looks at me, wide eyes. He goes, I'm not joking. I'm not kidding. The back room is on fire. The showroom's on fire. So, you know, we called the fire department came. We all piled out and we watched the place burn down in the back. I don't ever know what happened with that. There's a lot of different stories about what happened, how that it started. It was an arson thing.
An arson done by comics from the Comedy Store.
I've heard other stories Vegas.
Oh, really?
Like, kind of the mob and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was a club there too, but I don't know what the story is.
No one knows.
No.
When did you start coming into your own then? You're bartending, so you're doing what, one or two spots a week?
I'm bartending on Sunday, Monday nights, the slow nights, and I'm filling in if a comic doesn't show up.
Right.
Puts me on, which is fun.
So-and-so didn't show up. Who can go on? Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not only a bad bartender, he's a bad comic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did that for a while. I was getting some commercials. You know, I got an agent.
Did you hang out with Kaufman?
I would see him a lot at the Improv.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going up to him one night outside the front of the Improv because I was such a fan.
Yeah.
And I asked him about TM, Transcendental Meditation, because
yeah.
I knew he was into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, he talked to me for maybe a half hour about it. And I didn't hear a word he said. I was just looking at his face, looking at the moles on his face,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
just examining everything. And,
right. And he wasn't in character and he was just honest.
Yeah, he was just being very, yeah.
Oh, that's wild, man.
I think I dated like an ex-girlfriend of his for a while.
Because she was his ex-girlfriend?
No, no.
Just
because.
Well, they're around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, people who are around comedy, you're around comedy.
Yeah.
So when did you meet? Because, you know, I did see you. I was at the Gary Shandling's memorial. And it was so sad, but so life-affirming in some odd way. And your eulogy was so beautiful and so funny and so real and emotional. Did you plan that?
Well, he died March 24th, and the memorial's April 24th,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
So I had a month to think about what Gary meant to me. And the times we had together.
Yeah.
And what was so special about him.
Yeah.
And what was so unique and what was so unusual and what was so difficult about him.
Yeah.
You know, the whole being of Gary.
Yeah.
So I did plan it. And I would be on the road working and I would be looking at old texts and, you know, emails from him and, you know, thinking about him really because he was a good friend and I lost a good friend.
Yeah.
So yeah, I put a lot of that together and I shaped it and I thought about it and I thought about how would I get through this?
Well, yeah.
You know, because I'm not good at that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I tried to make it light at times.
Right.
And add a joke.
Yeah.
You know, which was also kind of, you know, talked about the essence of Gary.
Yeah, it was amazing.
He wrote that with me. Because I would write with him so often on the phone
or
in person, you know, or from out of town somewhere.
Yeah.
And I could just hear him thinking, no, this doesn't flow here. You know, that doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was.
It was very powerful.
It was a very cathartic for me to be able to have that time and do that and to deliver it.
When did you start hanging out with him?
I don't know the exact time, but it was probably in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Just because we both had the same passion and same desires. And so I'd see him in the comedy clubs.
And you guys are joke guys too. Like, you know, you write your shit.
Yeah, yeah. It is jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it is now, but it's, I remember coming from doing a college gig a couple years ago, maybe 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
And the girl driving me back to the airport, the college kid, she's quiet in the car. And then halfway there, she goes, I really enjoyed your act. Old school.
Really?
Yeah. And so I guess they are jokes, but
I don't say that in a condescending way. I just mean like we all do jokes.
Yeah.
But there are guys like the one thing that, you know, having, I talked to Gary in here, you know, and it was great. You know, it was very spiritual and thoughtful and as candid as he's, you know, willing to get because I didn't know him that well. But I found myself, you know, really sort of impressed and moved and inspired by him as a person. And I didn't know him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I knew his work and I always liked him, But, you know, when I was at the memorial, like, it was really, it was profoundly sort of moving to me to get the kind of the portrait of that guy from all you guys and just, you know, what was so special about him. And the reason I talk about jokes and the reason I say it with reverence is that, you know, there, you know, the way that you balance a joke or the way that he balances a joke and, you know, how it fits with your personality and the sort of control you execute over it and the risks you take within it. They're very real. There's a whole craft in place there. You know, I babble on until something works and then I do it again and then I trim it up. You know what I mean? There's not much on the paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, you know, I became very impressed with, because I don't know that I thought of him. Well, I think what really came together for me when you guys, you know, were reflecting on his life was that he really did show himself through his jokes. And I think that when, you know, when people say that old school or, you know, you do jokes or stuff, that the idea is like there's a distance there. But the thing I didn't really realize fully about him was that, like, he's all in it, you know, in his jokes.
Yeah. And his jokes or his material was always changing because he was always changing
in
discovery.
Yeah.
You know, and he was always trying to, like he did with his TV shows, always push it.
Yeah.
And try to get to that next level and evolve.
Yeah. You
know? So it was fun to see him with all of his legal pad papers crumbled and, you know, scribblings on there mixed in with the Buddhist sayings
things.
And then just, you know, the chaos of all that.
Well, the struggle to sort of, you know, kind of move your ego aside, you know, as a comic, you know, to find some sort of enlightenment when you're, you know, as neurotic as he was. I mean, that's like that had to be an ongoing struggle.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, if somebody said Gary's crazy, you couldn't argue with them.
Right.
You know, you would say, Yeah, he's crazy and he's talented and he's sensitive and but crazy is definitely one of the the characteristics. Yeah.
Did you guys tour together a lot?
We did some touring.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did a lot of touring. Not a lot, but we did a couple of tours here and there. And we get together on stage a lot. The Comedy Magic Club, we get on stage together and do like a little comedy team thing.
You don't see that much anymore, people playing like that. Maybe I'm not out enough, but like it used to happen at comedy clubs.
So. Yeah. I think he liked it because it was spontaneous and impulsive. And we both had a definite character we were doing.
Yeah.
Like I would say to him, why do you have to be with the potty mouth all the time? You know, and he would recoil and, you know, and he wouldn't, he actually liked it because he didn't want to be on stage alone because I guess he was going through a thing where he had stopped doing stand-up for a while and he was trying to get back into it and he felt more secure with me on there with him.
Right.
And eventually the plan was for me to leave the stage and let him do his act.
This is like just a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because I saw him, I never go down there, but I saw him once there, the Comedy Magic Club. He showed up there and it seemed like he was trying to get back in it. Yeah.
And it was interesting because also he was into boxing.
Yeah.
You know, he had a little boxing gym.
Yeah.
He and Peter Berg, you know, leased in Santa Monica. So he loved boxing. And he'd get on stage and he'd almost be going through boxing moves as he's doing his delivery.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And then after a while, it became like long, he would take long pauses on stage. And because people loved him and knew him, they allowed it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he was fishing for something or what, or if he was just
being present.
Trying to be as present and open as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like it might be it. That's I knew he was, but also the other thing that like I gleaned from everyone talking about him was just how secretly almost like in selfless he was in helping people out.
Yeah. That's, and I knew him well and I didn't know how much involved he was with these philanthropic causes.
And also just comics.
Comics.
You know, like you need a little help, a little writing, a little this, hang out, do the basketball game. The basketball game was famous.
I sent him a script once, an idea, a pilot that I wrote.
Yeah.
With my wife. And he, we never really talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And after he died, it was sitting on his office desk. This is like 2 years later.
Yeah.
You know. So it was constantly something that was on his mind, I think, and him wanting to get to it.
And just never got to it?
Either he got to it and he didn't like it and didn't want to tell me.
Maybe it's better off.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yes. Yes. But just that it was still on the table made me happy.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry you lost your friend. It's
Thank
a horrible
you.
Thing.
Thank you.
So how does SNL happen? You know, before I forget, you know, I was a guest on the Conspiracy Zone. You know that.
Were you really?
I was.
Which episode?
It was so weird, man. Like, that was like 2002, and I got, you know, it was like that, you know, and I was sort of like into conspiracies, kind of, but I, you know, I, it was kind of a vague show in a way.
It was, yeah.
And, you know, it was like, I think there was a panel of people, and you had certain...
I hosted it, and we had a panel of experts, quote unquote,
yeah,
on the topic.
Yeah.
And like we did one, Did We Really Land on the Moon?
Yeah,
and,
right.
And we tried to get Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
And... he called me at home. He goes, "I'm just not going to, I'm not going to validate it. Any of this by doing that. I yeah. appreciate you wanting me on the show, but I just thank you, but no, thank you." Yeah.
He was aware of the conspiracy
yeah.
theory.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on. Oddly, I was nervous about it, and I was on with Ann Coulter.
She was on too, huh?
Yeah, and at that time, which showed you, you know, how naive I was about politics and the whole world. I was so self-consumed or whatever, because a couple of years later I got very involved in politics, but I had no idea who she was.
And I probably didn't either.
Yeah. Well, you have a Booker, right? And yeah. I kind of knew you, and you kind of knew me, but I remember, I don't remember what I said or what we were talking about, but I was booked on that show and I did it. I don't know if anyone saw it.
That was Scott Carter created that show.
That was it. Scott Carter.
From Bill Maher's show.
Yeah, from Politically Incorrect. Yeah, yeah. yeah. That's why Coulter was on.
That's right. That's
right. That would have been it.
Yeah, that kind of came and went, that show. But it was fun doing it. Saturday Night Live came. I was not pursuing Saturday Night Live. I was a stand-up. All I wanted to do was stand-up.
And were you doing all right?
I was doing good, yeah. Yeah, I quit the bartending job. I was working on the road. I was doing some commercials.
And that was a big club boom, so there's a lot of clubs.
Yeah.
So you're headlining.
Yeah, because I did The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and that went well. And
what year was that?
That was 84.
And who were your friends at that time? Were you like, were you hanging out with Dana?
Well, I still have my answering machine from all my congratulations from my friends, like, you know, Gary Shandling.
Oh, really?
Brad Garrett, Paul Reiser, you know, those types of people.
Oh, really? You have the tape?
I do. Yeah. I'm nostalgic. I save a lot of stuff.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Johnny Carson, that kind of came quickly.
I a couple of years
got
in.
Into stand-up in like 78, yeah. 79, and that came in 84.
Yeah.
And I auditioned a few times before for Jim McCulley.
Sure.
And it's always nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
You know, and then I never passed. And then he calls and he says, "Hey, Mike Nesmith from the Monkees is doing a show. And he, you know, we'll put you on the bill too, see if you could pass, you know, see if you could be on the show." So I said, "I'm going to do what I think is funny and not do what I think Johnny Carson will like."
Uh-huh.
And I did that, and he calls me the next day. He goes, "Hey, the bad news is you're not doing the Mike Nesmith show. The good news is you're doing The Tonight Show if you'd like." So it happened very quickly. And
it meant something then.
It meant something. I mean, that was the show. It was the only show.
Right.
And Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
And now you don't even really put it on your resume because it dates you, you know.
Yeah. but at that time you do it and everyone watches, so you it ups your crowds, right?
Yeah.
You start, people want to see you at the club.
I had met this guy, Mike Brown. He's still a good friend of mine, my best friend. And he and I meshed together. He wasn't even a comedy writer. He worked for UPS.
Yeah.
You know, and we just hit it off and we started writing stuff together, and that's kind of ultimately what got me on The Tonight Show. And I'm going over my 5-minute act in my head. You know how you do before you go?
Oh, yeah.
And this is huge. I've never done a big TV show like this before. And I'm going over it, like, because 3 days later, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And you could be talking to me now, and I'd be nodding. You think I'm listening, but really, I'm going over my act.
Sure, yeah.
I get to The Tonight Show. I had been there before. When I first moved out here, I would go all the time to The Tonight Show because it was free tickets.
Yeah.
It was like a Vegas show.
So you'd go watch.
I would go watch.
You did a lot of watching before you did.
A lot of watching.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of pacing. And so I'm behind the curtain. Jim McCulley's there, and the band's playing. I know the band. I know everybody in the band because I watched them so many times.
Yeah, I know
where Johnny's sitting.
Yeah.
And the band stops, and I'm going over my act in my head.
Yeah.
And Johnny introduces me. The curtains open up. A crowd applause. I go blank.
No.
I cannot
think
of my act. I swear to God, I cannot think of my act, which has been a current nightmare for me over the years.
Oh, how could that go away?
And I get out to my mark, and they're applauding still, and I'm trying to remember my opening line. And the applause subside, and it comes into my head, and I start, and I'm getting laughs, and applauses, and laughs, and I can't believe it. And Johnny behind me, I could hear him laughing, and Ed McMahon, and I'm out on the floor now. I'm doing what I've watched so many people do, even from the improv, watching the other comics on the
on
TV set.
Yeah.
Out there. And I do it, and I finish, and I go back behind the curtain. Johnny gives me the okay thing. I go behind the curtain. I'm so happy. I'm so relieved. And Jim McCulley goes, "Okay, great job. Hang here. I think Johnny's going to want you to come out and talk to you after the commercial.
Yeah.
And I said, what? He goes, yeah, what can we talk about? He goes, oh, you'll do fine. Just go out there. Yeah. So I go out there and bam, more jokes, bam. And it's like the prize fight that I always wanted. You know? It was like my dream come true. And to this day, it's the highlight of my, over Saturday Night Live or Weeds or anything like that.
Right.
That was the highlight of my career. And then I went to my friend Mike's house and watched it with him and his wife, Anita. And I knew everybody was at the Improv watching it.
Yeah.
And the place just was quiet there. People tell me, quiet. And everybody just applauded afterwards. And it was like the biggest thing of the, you know, to this day.
Yeah.
I'm still like, you know, floating on air. And and between the time I taped it and before it aired that night, I was praying there wouldn't be some disaster.
Right.
Where they were
preempting.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an amazing experience. An amazing story.
It was totally cool.
The electricity of it, because like, and it was Johnny.
It was Johnny Carson. And he, in between, you know, in the commercials, he's smoking the cigarette.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I picked the video of him throwing his head back, laughing at a joke, you know?
Yeah.
It was just everything I dreamt of.
Oh, it's so good that worked out for
you.
And also that there was that moment where it went away.
It went away.
Oh, man.
I remember I did one of the subsequent spots I did on there. You know, I approved it all with Jim McCauley.
Yeah.
And I go out there and I said, you know, I'm getting ready for the holidays. I'm doing a lot of drinking and driving.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that Johnny had a DUI. You know, he's like a famous DUI or something. You know?
Right.
And Jim McCauley after goes, hey, where did that joke come from? I said, that was always the first joke. He goes, no, I never proved that. You know, so they garbled it when they aired it.
Oh, they did?
And I come out, I go, how's it going, everybody? Well, I'm getting ready for the holidays.
No.
Yeah. And I don't think I ever did the show again after that.
Really?
Yeah. But it doesn't matter because the first one I did, I've only done maybe 8 of them. I don't know. Maybe four.
Yeah.
But then I did a lot with Jay and Shanling and Joan Rivers.
Oh, you did a lot.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember the first Letterman because Letterman was more my generation's guy. You know, I mean, yeah. I love Johnny, but he was gone before that ended.
That was the race, too. That was the chase to get on before he left.
Yeah.
So there was a ticking clock, too.
Right. Yeah. You know. But like doing Letterman the first time was mind-blowing.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good one, too.
Yeah, but it took like years before I talked to him, you know, like where I sat. I actually did an all-panel one with him before, you know. And it was that feeling of like, because that was always really the grail as a comic. It wasn't really getting a TV show or any of that for me. It was like, you want to do that. You want to go be a comic.
Yeah.
On the TV, you know.
That's what you're aiming for.
That's the grail. Like, you know, it really meant something to do Letterman. You know, I'd have friends who did it and be like, oh, fuck, when am I going to do Letterman? You know?
I know.
So how did SNL happen?
I was living in a house in the Hollywood Hills, and then Dana Carvey would rent the room over the garage when he was in town. There's a little apartment, a studio apartment over the garage. And I knew Dana from the stand-up clubs.
Yeah.
And I was dating Jan Hooks at the time.
Oh, yeah.
I had known Jan Hooks for 7 years. Always was attracted to her. We became really good friends, you know, but she was always dating somebody else.
Right.
But ultimately, we ended up dating.
Yeah.
That year that Dana got, that summer that he got SNL, and Jan was up for it. And I was excited for them both. I was reading Backstage Live, Saturday Night Live, the original years.
Yeah.
And I was excited, never thinking that I would even be considered for it. You had to have a high power agent to get you a showcase even. And so I get a call from Dana that summer.
Yeah.
He goes, Kev, I'm out at Lorne Michaels' house. I'm in the back bedroom. Yeah. Guess who's in the kitchen? Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. I said, you're kidding me. No. Anyway, I told Lorne about you. They're looking for another cast member. I told him he might want to see your videos. I said, Bill Murray's in the kitchen with Dan Aykroyd? He goes, yeah. Holy shit. And he goes, well, I got to go. Somebody's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I send him my tapes thinking nothing's going to happen from it.
Right, right. What kind of tapes, though? What were they?
It was a stand-up from The Tonight Show and, you know, things like that. I sent it in. I don't think I'll hear back. 2 weeks later, Dana calls me back. I'm back out of Lauren Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen? Steve Martin.
Yeah.
I said, no way. Anyway, Lauren likes your tapes. I think they're going to fly you in for an audition.
Yeah.
I said, Steve Martin's in the kitchen. He goes, yeah. I got to go. Somebody's coming. And so now I'm in the mix. So they're going to fly me in, and I fly into New York thinking it's just a free trip to New York. I'm not going to get anything from it. You know, I'm a stand-up. I don't get characters or sketches. Yeah. And everybody else is on the plane is going in for that one role, too.
Yeah.
It's never easy. Even the pilot comes out of the cockpit, hey, you think this is funny for my audition? And so I get there, and everybody's nervous and sweating. I'm having a good time. I'm excited. Here's 30 Rock. Oh, wow, this is cool, you know? And They call me in. I do my little audition. I do some stand-up. And I do, you know, Dana and I worked on a few characters, like in the driveway of our house. We would kind of jam on different ideas. So they were loose characters, you know.
Yeah.
And so I flew back to L.A. thinking I'll never hear back. And next thing I know, I'm meeting with Lorne Michaels at some high-rise in Century City. He's offering me a job on SNL. You know, he talked for about an hour about the show and what I would be doing. And he excused himself to go to the restroom. Brad Grey was my manager at the time.
Right.
And also his manager. And he goes, here's what we should tell him. Tell him to think about it over the weekend. You know? And I'm thinking, are you crazy?
Yeah.
So it was almost timing, like they had it planned.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And Lauren comes back and he sits down. And, well, what do you think? I said, well, let me think about it over the weekend. And he looks at me and goes, well, you think about it over the weekend and we'll see you in New York on Monday. So I'm at a Lorne Michaels house, you know, and then I got a call from Dana.
Yeah.
Kev, I'm out in the back bedroom. Guess who's in the kitchen? I said, I am, motherfucker. I'm in the kitchen now. I'm in the kitchen.
That was it.
That was it. Yeah. And then Jan got hired on the show and it was an interesting run.
Is it long, how long? Was it like 6 years?
I was on for 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been really lucky. You know, I've had really good long runs. SNL.
Yeah.
Weeds was for 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm on a new show that's hopefully will be running for a long time.
What's it called?
It's called Man with a Plan.
Oh, yeah. CBS. That's what you're here to promote.
Well, not necessarily.
No, I know. But
it's Monday nights at 8:30.
Oh, CBS, good. Yeah. We got that in. No, but like with SNL, like were you, was he thinking of you for Update? Well, I mean, was that the slot?
I think he might have been. Dennis was doing it at the time and he was doing well. But I think, you know, if the day ever came that Dennis was leaving, that he thought, Dana told me that Dina Minot, who worked for Lorne at the time, one of the producers, said, Dana, do you know any like Chevy Chase types? Like, we need a tall guy. And Dana goes, well, I actually know this guy, Kevin Nealon, he's tall and funny. And,
yeah.
You know, so maybe that had something to do with it.
Right. But what were you doing initially? You did a few characters?
Well, I did Mr. Subliminal.
Oh, that's right.
Because I was doing that in my act.
Yeah.
And I went to school for that. And then Al Franken and I kind of came together and wrote the advertising guy.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then the next year, Dana and I came up with the Hans and Franz characters.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And, but I was more the everyday guy, you know? I wasn't like big on characters because I never did characters.
Right.
Anything I did, like if it was Brent Musburger or something, it was just because somebody came up with it. I looked like them maybe.
Yeah.
You know, if I pull my eyes down.
But you can do voices and stuff.
I can do voices, yeah. In fact, I wanted to be an impressionist originally, but then I thought, I want people to do impressions of me.
Right.
Not
doing
impressions of other people, you know?
Yeah, I liked your Update. I was on board.
You know, I look at it now and I think, yeah, I would do it differently now.
You do?
Back then, I liked the way Chevy Chase did it. So I try to keep it kind of real, dry.
Yeah, dry.
You know?
Yeah.
But I look back now and I kind of cringe. But, you know, at the time, that's what I chose.
The jokes were good.
Jokes were good. I wrote them all. I had people faxing me jokes.
I think that's why I liked it, because I knew it was you. You know, Dennis wasn't even trying to do a newscast.
Right, right.
You know, but you were honoring the format.
Exactly.
And you know, you knew what you could do comedically, and, you know, you kind of made it your own in a way, but honored the original idea.
Yeah.
I'm a newscaster.
Yeah, that's it. I'm a straight, you know, dry newscaster.
Yeah.
Here's the news.
Yeah,
that's news to me.
Yeah, that's right. That was funny. Who was, like, you went through a lot, there were a lot of guys around you. I mean, you do a lot of Sandler movies, so I assume you're close to Sandler.
Well, Sandler I met on SNL.
Yeah.
Actually, I met him at the comedy club in New York.
Yeah.
The
comic strip or the improv?
It was a comic strip.
Yeah. That makes
comic
sense.
Strip club. Yeah. And he was a young kid at the time, and we're walking back to the Catch a Rising Star at another club, and he knows I'm at SNL. He's excited. He went back and told all his roommates at NYU that he hung out with me, you know, and then ultimately he gets on the show and he does Weekend Update a lot when I'm doing Weekend Update. And, you know, I'm open to him doing whatever
Opera
he wants
Man
to do. Opera Man, redhead and sweatshirt. Yeah. Yeah. And so he's very grateful, I guess, about that. And we become buddies. And he's kind of loyal in that way. He uses the same kind of group of guys, you know, on a lot of his films.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I was watching this. You ever see Charlie Chaplin, Untold? I think it's called Untold Chaplin.
Mm-mm.
Something like that. He always burned all of his cuts, you know, his edits.
Yeah.
His guy burned them all. But apparently his editor didn't burn them all, and they put together this string. It's Unknown Chaplin, that's what it's called. And he put together this thing, a DVD, and it shows how he works on all his films and how the pain and how long it takes to get him and how the scene changes so much. Maybe it starts with a fountain in the lobby of the hotel.
Yeah.
And then they get rid of that because it's not working. They put a staircase there.
Yeah.
Or an escalator. And it was really interesting to watch that. But I noticed that he used a lot of the same actors in all of his films.
Sure.
So I guess, you know, it's kind of...
Well, no, I think ensembles are good. You get to know people and, you know, and also I think people who watch the movies are happy to see everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, you're familiar with them.
And I know Steve directed a couple you were in.
Steve did, yeah.
That when you had the boobs on your head.
Little Nicky.
Yeah.
Yep, Little
Odd
Nicky.
Odd movie. The weirdest Sandler movie, I think.
That was, and that one, I guess, didn't do that well for the Sandman, but he did what he wanted to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he that's the great thing about Sandler. You know, he does what he thinks is funny.
Yeah.
And it most of them work all the time.
And are you friends with Spade and everybody?
Yep, Spade. I see Dana a lot.
I just had Eugene Levy in here. He lives up.
Oh,
by
I
you.
Love Eugene.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did yesterday. A sitcom together once.
Which one?
And it was called Hiller and Diller with Richard Lewis. Yeah, me and Richard Lewis and Eugene Levy. And he's great, man. I love him. Don't go golfing with him.
No.
It takes him forever to hit the ball. Eugene, he gets out of the car and goes, interesting. Ah, let's see. Yeah. Yeah, okay. No, not that one. You're like, geez, come on.
You play a lot of golf?
I don't play a lot of golf. I play like once a year, and I'm not good. But I do one tournament in the summer, and it's called the American Century Championship. And it's on NBC.
Yeah.
A lot of athletes play.
Yeah.
Tony Romo.
Charity?
Aaron Rodgers. A lot of charity stuff, yeah. And it's on camera. And it took me like, I've been playing that for like 12, 13 years now.
Yeah.
In the first 6 years, I was a nervous wreck. I mean, now it doesn't matter, you know?
Oh, wait. Oh, thank God. I hate when I get like a text, you know, on here. Yeah. I am in the middle of a conversation and it's like an issue.
Yeah.
It wasn't a major issue. Nothing for you to be concerned about. I was still 100% present. I maybe missed 20 seconds.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you that.
No, I know. I know those 20 seconds.
You did?
Yeah.
You felt it?
Yeah.
When was it?
I said something funny and you didn't hear it.
Oh.
So I did the laugh. I did a little courtesy laugh for myself.
Well, I apologize. That's not
right.
Like
no,
me.
No, that's all right.
Oh.
I remember pitching an idea once to a producer.
Yeah.
And I would look down at my notes. And every time I looked up, I would catch him watching the game behind me on the TV with the sound off.
I had a guy, I went to a meeting with an agent once when I was looking for an agent, and the guy had just gotten a Casio address book phone when they were popular.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally spent a half an hour telling me about the phone. Did not ask me any questions. It was what I, you know, I felt when I left, like, oh, yeah, I get one, I think. I'm going to have to get one. And that was
it's horrible going into those things. I remember one guy, I was reading lines
you know,
for a part.
Yeah.
And he started laughing. Yeah. He got into a laughing fit. We couldn't stop laughing. And at first I thought it was kind of funny, you know, and maybe he was laughing at the way I did something, you know?
Yeah.
And then I realized he was kind of laughing at the situation that I was there reading probably for him and I was bad.
Right.
And how his job.
Laughing
and,
for the wrong reason.
Yeah, yeah. And then he said, I'm sorry. I said, okay, well, it's nice meeting you. And I left. You know, I could hear him laughing as I left.
My friend Jerry has a story about going into pitch and he's pitching to the guy and the guy's distracted and seems upset. And there's a pause and I guess the guy says, yeah, I'm sorry, my mother passed away today. And Jerry's like, okay. He goes, but go ahead. Just horrible moments in show business.
Man. It is the worst.
You always work and you're always engaged and you do work outside the box and you're not afraid to, I didn't see Weeds. I'm sorry.
You would have loved it.
I'm going to watch it.
I tell Howard Stern the same thing. He's never seen it. I said, you and Mark Maron would have loved Weeds.
I was on the show once with Howard.
Were you?
It was a big deal. It was another one of those big deals. Because, like, I didn't grow up with Howard, but, like, I know, like, on some level, we do a similar thing. And, you know, I was always intimidated by Howard.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I finally got an opportunity to do the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd be shitting on podcasts and whatever. And
he
doesn't want to acknowledge that they exist. That's fine. I just wanted to have the Howard experience. And it was funny because it was one of these, like, I was nervous. I'm like, what's he going to find on me?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
What's he coming at me with?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was nervous. I was sitting there and I'm watching the TV and, you know, I'm sitting there waiting and they have the screen of Howard on break in there. And I just see him in there. He doesn't have his sunglasses on. And he's eating cantaloupe out of a bowl. And I'm like, that's just a Jew eating cantaloupe. You know, like, I can handle this.
Yeah.
What am I afraid of? And I go in there, and they try to to fuck with your head. Like you walk in, all of a sudden you have headphones on, and you're in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I'm onto that trick. I'm not going to throw me.
Well, I woke up maybe 3 years ago, and I said I want to do things that excite me, that scare me a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm tired of just playing the game that I know.
Right.
And one of the things was doing the Howard Stern show, and the other one was the Bill Maher show, real time, because I'm not that politically, a political junkie or anything.
Yeah.
And I did both of those shows several times, and it was great. It was so exhilarating.
If Bill likes you and he knows you, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But Howard, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I went in there and it couldn't have been, I think he likes comics.
Yeah, oh, he definitely does. Nice. A lot of my friends used to do it, and I was always upset I couldn't do it. And then when I walked in there, worried about what he was going to have on me.
I know. You anticipate everything. I had answers for everything. Didn't have to use any of them.
All he said was so I hear you're an asshole. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is easy. Sure, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can answer to the asshole thing. And it was fine. It was, it was good. I'd like to go back. But do you feel that same way about acting? Like when you do something like Weeds?
Well, I've been really lucky because I've had a lot of, I've been able to write as a job. I've been able to act in a lot of different... I've done single camera Weeds, live TV, Saturday Night Live, and now I'm doing a multiple camera show and movies with Sandler. So, my career has always been kind of interesting for me. I didn't get caught in one rut, and I have the stand-up that I do.
You still go out a lot?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep.
Where do you play?
At the Comedy Works in Denver.
I love that place.
March 24th
That place
and 25th.
Is almost too good.
Yeah.
March 24th and 25th is the Comedy Works. So it's a great place to work stuff out, but you can't trust it because the room is so hot.
It is hot. I filmed a special there.
You did?
Yeah. So in that sense, I've been kind of lucky. I've done a lot of things that keep me interested.
So what's The Man with the Plan? Is that your shit? Did you create it?
No, I didn't.
Don't get angry.
This is a plan.
Angry Kevin?
I've created a couple other shows that didn't go.
Which ones?
Well, you don't know them. One was called Stays in Vegas.
Yeah.
And the other one was called The Pleaser.
How far did they get?
Well, we got them to studios, Warner Brothers and Fox.
You didn't shoot either?
Didn't shoot them, no. They didn't sell them to a network.
The Pleaser would be about you and your people pleasing?
Yeah. Pretty much. Which we turned into a film.
Yeah?
And now we're looking for investors to shoot that.
Oh, what's an outreach today? Maybe someone's listening. I'm ready.
Brillstein Entertainment Partners.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're still with them?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So anyway, I've done those two. But Man with a Plan is, I was just doing stand-up. I was writing this film, The Pleaser. And then my agent sent me the script. They said, you have a chemistry meeting with Matt LeBlanc if you'd like to do this show. So they sent me the script and I read it. And
a chemistry meeting.
It's really an audition.
You hit it off with the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice way of saying audition to someone who's been in the business for a while.
Oh, okay.
And they don't want to insult you. Yeah.
But it does mean you're going to be reading with the primary.
Yeah.
Right.
So that morning I had a dentist appointment.
Yeah.
And there was more work that needed to be done than I thought. The chemistry meeting is out in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So they got me tilted back in the chair and he's got to give me extra Novocaine. And I see the clock ticking.
Come on.
And my audition's like in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
That's all the time I'm going to have to get there.
Yeah.
So I said, I got to go. It wrapped up and he gave me extra Novocaine. My whole side of my face is numb.
Yeah.
So I said, how long will this take for the wear off? He goes, by this afternoon you should be. And I got in a half hour. Okay. I got to be. So I'm tapping it all the way and I'm driving the canyons, looking at my lines and stuff. And I'm sitting in the room and Matt LeBlanc comes in, off to the side.
Yeah.
The producers are in another room. They're waiting.
Yeah.
He goes, hey, you want to run this for a little? We'll try it? Go, okay. So we try it. And then he goes into the other room. They go, how is he? He goes, well, he's really funny. A little shaky in the lines. And he probably said, he probably had a stroke. The guy had a stroke.
It's what he said?
Because my whole side was like, no, like that,
He's got Bell's palsy.
Yeah. But anyway, so they hired me. He liked me. And Matt LeBlanc's amazing. He's really, I thought I knew everything about comedy and getting the most out of a laugh. But he knows structure and character.
Really?
He's been doing it so long. I mean, he could just look at a scene and go, no, this is missing. We need this. We need that. And
just
I,
from all that, all those years.
All those years and Friends.
Yeah.
And Joey and episodes. And,
isn't that interesting? Because I guess there's an element to doing that type of, three camera thing that, is not in your wheelhouse.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's a very, it can be pretty shticky sometimes and it's hard to subvert the shtick to make it real enough to not be dumb.
Yeah. I think it's a really good show. He's great in it. Yeah. Liza Snyder's great.
Yeah.
You know, Matt Cook. So many great actors in there. Of course, myself, probably the best. But
yeah. How many did you shoot?
Well, we started with 13. I wasn't in the pilot. I came after the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
We shot 13, then got picked up for a back nine. So 22.
Great.
But it's great because I wanted to be home more. I didn't want to be on the road so much.
Yeah.
And this is like perfect job. It's a great schedule.
Do you feel like you have to go out there? I mean, is it, well, I mean, that's sort of a weird personal question. Is it financial or you love to do stand up?
Well, I love to do stand up.
Yeah.
I love making money too. The money's good now.
Sure.
You know, there's not many of us that can go out and make that much money.
Sure.
And, you know,
Yeah.
As a comic established, you can go out and make a good hunk of change.
Yeah, I know. This has been the first time I've been able to do that.
You can make up the $2,000 in one weekend.
It's amazing. Do you remember the day where you realized, like when I started making money as a stand-up, I mean, it took a long time. It took, you know, up to just like 5 years ago because of the podcast or whatever, that I had an audience. And like, you know, the first time you do a door deal at a club and you get that check and you're like, wait, what? This is all for, is this a mistake? But then a moment after that, you like all those dudes back in the 80s, you know, who were big then and you're middling or featuring, they're like, they were walking. Like when I was doing $1,500 weeks thinking I was winning, those guys were walking with all that cash.
Yeah, I know.
It was mind blowing.
And now they're not.
Well, I hope they saved it.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Now this new approach to life that you're having, you know, with the experiencing your anger, is that integrated into the act? Or are you got an edge now?
No, I don't think I'll ever have an edge. But you know, self revelation, I guess, is always helpful. You know, when you're writing, you're standing up and how you think about things. I think a comic is kind of like a blues musician. You have to kind of live life. You have to evolve to create some kind of, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to get stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's one of the liabilities of a lot of the guys we talk about that have sort of gone, you know, toward the wayside. There are some dudes that are always writing new stuff, but there was definitely a generation of comics that couldn't get past the first hour.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have to constantly keep digging deeper into yourself, too. Like Gary would say, you know, you got to stay open and present and truthful, you know, if you want to do that kind of comedy.
And that's like that. I got very reassured, sadly, at the memorial about, you know, what I was doing, you know, by hearing about him and getting to know him through you guys. Like it really had a profound impact on me, you know, because I work like that. I am pretty, you know, put myself out there. There's never like I never feel protected on a comedy stage. It's not sort of like I'm going to hide behind jokes. I just don't have that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like when things are like they are now, where, you know, things are up in the air and scary and everything, I'm scared. So I got to go out there and I've got to somehow share that as a common experience.
Yeah.
And it's daunting.
And
but
you're brave to do that too. I mean, there, you know, a lot of comedy now is confessional comedy.
Yeah.
And people are don't seem to have a problem with confessing to whatever they do that may not be accepted.
Yeah. It really puts you on the spot. And it also, I think, is a reaction to the fact that, you know, if you don't have a very defined point of view and you're writing topical material or trying to be an observer, because there's so many comics, you know, someone else is going to be fucking doing the joke. So in a lot of ways, all you got is yourself.
Yeah.
So it better be specific.
You got to be as specific as possible. I tell like newer comics that too. I say there's so many comics now. You got to be original. You got to be unique. Otherwise, you'll just blend in to the background. You'll work maybe, but, you know, you'll never really.
And sometimes it's hard to, you can't just do that on purpose. It has to evolve.
It has to evolve. And, you know, I go out and I do comedy maybe two times a week now, two or three times a week around town.
Yeah.
And I see other comics who are like I was, these younger comics that are doing maybe three sets a night, every night.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wow, man, if I was doing that, I would have like 2 hours of material within a year.
Sure.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I think when you're in touch with your emotions, it really helps. And I think getting therapy also as a comic is helpful because it helps you dig into that.
Yeah, yeah, to figure out where some of it's coming from, put it together.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there was a joke I was working on that was completely, you know, like the only way I got confidence from it was, you know, from thinking about Gary and thinking about you, is that because I don't, when I have a structured joke, you know, it's very easy for me to think it's some sort of trick.
Yeah.
You know, but like if there's a structured joke, you know, because I have jokes, but like I do it conversationally. But like if I have one where I'm like, I know there are beats here and I have to wait for this,
yeah.
and it might not work, but I believe in it. Like, I had a couple of those, and they came after, you know, I was at the memorial service, and I was like, you know, I'm going to do this, you know, by drawing from the inspiration of Gary. And like, it felt very satisfying to yeah. sort of like hold it, you know, just don't, you know, don't second guess it, let it sit. It's a tough one to process.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's worth it.
Yeah.
And I stuck with it and it worked. It was very, no, I don't know why I'm telling you, I'm just telling you.
No, I love hearing stuff like that because I'm always trying to examine the avenue of comedy and what would improve my delivery or my, you know, yeah. writing or performance. And it's you're always learning something new. And that's why I like trying to get out and mix with people.
Yeah.
'Cause you could watch and learn things. And
yeah.
And it's every time you get on stage, there's something can happen.
That's
you know,
right.
There's a revelation there.
Yeah.
You allow it to happen.
I have to. It's like, sometimes the best things that happen on stage are those moments that like probably no one really noticed quite. But
yeah.
you're like that. Oh, that thing I did when I just said that thing out of nowhere. That was the best part of that hour and a half.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, I haven't seen your act in a while, but you when I used to see you, and I've seen you on TV.
Yeah,
more of an anger kind of a thing.
Not
do you, do you go on stage thinking nobody likes you?
I used to. That's sort of gone. Like that sort of went away in the last 5 years. And the reason it went away was, you know, I became more comfortable with myself by doing this.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm really not, you know, I'm worked up sometimes, and I'm still sort of, you know, self-centered and neurotic, but I'm not angry because a lot of that was really just fear.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it something happened, like, 5 years ago, like, I started doing theaters, you know, and, like, there was this moment where I'm, like, I always go early, you know, to the sound checker to see the space and to walk around it, and there was just this moment where I'm like, I live up here. Like some part of me, this is the one place where, you know,
safe.
Yeah, I own this place. You know what am I assuming the worst for? And it was lifted.
Yeah.
Like I don't have any fear.
Yeah, this is your home.
Right.
I remember going through breakups.
Yeah.
I would always get devastated. Even if I went out with it for 6 months, you know, the world was over and
I'd
shave, I'd get in bed, and then I would do these stand-up gigs where I'd have to get on stage, you know, as miserable as I was.
Right.
But then I would forget about it for like, you know, 20 minutes or a half hour, and I would be okay. And then it was like leaving Disneyland when I got off the stage, like, oh, back to the real world.
Exactly.
Now, you know?
Yeah, that definitely happened. And I've gone through breakups and divorces where I would process them on stage. And those were not great shows for people. I don't know that... I don't know if it was everyone's idea of a night out, but
no, I know. I think sometimes you could be abusive with the audience, and I've seen a lot of comics, and I've probably done it too, where you just stay on stage because they're letting you because you're well known, and you just rambling, and you're not getting any laughs,
and
you're using the audience,
and it's weird though because that quietness, that weird silence of them tolerating you, there's no more. It's almost like there's a freedom to it. Like you're all alone, and it's all your space.
Yeah,
and it's a very weird feeling when they don't know what's happening and you don't know what's going to happen, and you're just standing there. There's some weird elation to that. And a lot of times, if I'm not doing as well as I want to be doing, that's when I'll go long. Like, I'll just keep going.
You'll make them pay.
Well, yeah, there's that angle, but I'd like to frame it as like, well, at least I don't want them walking out going like, you know, we didn't get our money's worth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, if it wasn't as funny as they wanted, they could walk out and go like, he fucking did 2 hours. Like, it wasn't great, but God, he tried.
But the thing, when you get on stage, though, the audience is looking to you. They want to know that you're comfortable and that you're running the show. Because if you're not, they feel uncomfortable. It's like you're a bad pilot.
Right. What's going to happen?
So you got to kind of like let them know that you're in charge.
Yeah.
And everything's going to be cool.
And they got to believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And make it okay for them to laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
But if you go on stage and you're like upset and you know, you're frazzled.
They're like, oh no,
fuck, this guy's not good. It's going to
be a problem for this. It's going to be a draining evening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, so
I'm gonna have to give some fake laughs to make them feel better. That's a lot of work for me.
Oh, that the feeling of bombing, like those bombs where like there's nothing you can do, and like it's probably your fault.
Yeah,
you know, like you're just not connecting, and like that feeling of like, you know, I'm not gonna get out of this.
But I think that's good, though, to be able to be in that position. I very rarely put myself in that. Like, I'll take old stuff I know is going to kill just so that they get laughs and buffer, I walk off with an applause, you know?
But there's been a couple of times in my life where something just collapsed, where the fear or whatever, or I just, you know, the confidence went away. It's been a long time, but where I got to go up for an hour and I try. And then, like, you know, I remember there was a time where I was less professional. I think part of being a professional is not letting this happen, where I just lost all of my confidence.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and I'm up there doing it, but it's not, you know, it's not.
Yeah, yeah. You don't believe in it.
Right. And the job isn't happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I was just going to ask you, do you still get nervous before you go on stage? Because I don't get nervous anymore. And I think you should have some nerves.
I get nervous in the fact where It's I'm not afraid to be up there, but like I want to make sure I plant myself there. And it used to be by getting the laugh.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I got that first bit, it's going to get a laugh. And now it's really something different. Like I need to be like, this will be all right. You know, like,
Like
I need to have that connection, not the laugh, but the sort of like, are we on this? Are we going to be all right here?
Yeah, yeah.
And then go, you know, so. Yeah, yeah. So I'm nervous about that won't happen. Because you feel it, man. You know, you go out into a room and you're like, no, that corner, that's going to be a problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or you find that one person.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's not laughing.
Yeah, I tend to find, like, I always end up looking at those people at the moment they're not laughing. You know, and there's always, like, if you're playing, like, a bigger place, like, you know, 800 people or whatever, there's always, you're always going to land on people, like a sleeping lady.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, sometimes when you do clubs and, you know that they're not all necessarily there to see you. They might just be, you know, there's like that table, that area, there's some bad thing happening over there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. There's always a spot. No matter where you are, you'll find it.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Like, I don't know if I'm going to get that area.
Mm-hmm.
And now I make all assumptions. Like, they hate me. And then there are always the guys that come up to you like, I loved it. And you're like, no, you're not who I thought you were.
Yeah.
Why don't you not like me?
I can remember only bombing once really badly.
Yeah.
And it was a couple years ago. I worked at that Marine base down by between in Ocean City, there, Oceanside, whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
I forget, it's Fort something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for Marines like 19 and under that were single. Right.
Yeah, kids.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I could not connect with them at all.
Kids are hard.
They were checking their texts, you know, their texting and stuff, and didn't get it. They didn't even know like my history of Hans and Franz or anything.
Nothing,
man.
Whole new generation.
I was going through my Rolodex.
Who's
my
the
head.
Old guy?
Yeah. And everything was hip hop. There was the main guy was the hip hop guy at the end, the headliner.
Yeah.
And then the MC was an ex hip hop guy who's MCing now, and he's an ex Marine, so he knows all the lingo.
Oh, did you know going in? You're like,
I didn't know. And then I walked off. I was sweating actually. I hadn't sweat in a long time.
That's
I
walked the worst. Off.
And I tried to convince the producer. I said, hey, God, that was good, man. These guys are great. And I just hated myself. I just kind of put a fake smile on, like, this is the greatest thing
sweat.
In the world.
The bomb sweat?
Oh, man.
When you feel it coming, you're like, oh, no.
It's like bad food poisoning or something.
Terrible. It's happening.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm not hiding it. It's coming out of me.
It's going to happen, baby. It's going to happen. It's happening now.
Ease into it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Mark.
That was great talking to you.
You too.
What a great guy. What a great conversation. I'm so glad that we made that happen finally. Vancouver, Portland, Seattle, Oakland, Denver, Boulder, D.C., Philly, Austin, Milwaukee, Madison, Minneapolis. Dig it. No music today. Boomer lives!